Greetings in your post-Christmas glow, just before the year ends. Robin Williams with Science Extra. We'll be featuring a severe warning in Occam's Razor from Rhys Halter in Los Angeles about killing our creatures. We'll have another PhD to offer a glimpse of the future, and right now, a return to the cage full of monkeys like Brian Cox, just to prove science can have an audience of many, many thousands in the mud at Glastonbury.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please, for Glastonbury 2013, put your hands together, go absolutely wild with applause for Robin Ince, Brian Cox and Infinite Monkey Kane!
So basically what happened was we did Glastonbury 2 years ago and they asked us to do it again, and Brian said, well, if we're doing Glastonbury, why don't we do something simple and gentle about poetry or why stars are pretty? And I said, no, we have got an audience of people who will be quite confused by this stage of the festival. Quantum cosmology is the only idea, and you are the perfect audience for quantum cosmology, because I believe you are displaying quantum behaviour. Many of you are both dead and alive. You are here and you are not here. You are indeed all in superpositions.
Yes, today we'll be looking at quantum cosmology. Are time and space, as Einstein envisaged, a smooth fabric with the future as real as the past? Or does quantum theory save us from deterministic drudgery? Are there really an infinite number of parallel universes, or is this it? What happens inside a black hole? Was there anything before the Big Bang? Is there a possibility that I might one day meet another me from another world where I am shorter, without my trademark good looks and great hair, and with no real understanding of particle physics?
Am I the other Brian Cox? Have I come here to this world to kill him in some kind of Philip K. Dick nightmare? So, to help us explain, and when I say us, I do not include me, because I have no idea. We were actually up last night talking about these ideas, and they are fantastically bamboozling. Our first guest is a professor of theoretical physics at Imperial College London, where she specialises in quantum cosmology. She has never been to the Glastonbury Festival before, but as someone who studied many worlds interpretation, she also knows that she has been to every single Glastonbury Festival before. Sometimes as a human, sometimes as a sentient droplet of pear juice. She is someone dealing with very confusing worlds. It is Faye Dowker.
Our next guest works on the phenomenology of elementary particle physics. And trying to say phenomenology without thinking about the Muppets is difficult.
Try it, phenomenology.
Do, 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 do.
Thank you.
He's also co-writer of books with a popular TV scientist, such as Why Does Equals MC Squared and The Quantum Universe. It is Professor Jeff Forshaw.
Like so many of our regular guests, Professor Richard Dawkins, Sir Paul Nurse and the Astronomer Royal Sir Martin Rees, today one of our guests is also a former podium dancer like them. Richard Dawkins, of course, used to be a podium dancer at the Heaven nightclub until a falling out after their refusal to change its name to a finite existence followed by an inevitable death without any sense of being nightclub. He is a regular on Have I Got News For You, The Now Show, and sometimes also goes under the name Giles Wembley Hogg, and he is Marcus Brigstar!
And our final guest is a musician who we had to have on because she titled her albums Eye to the Telescope and Crescent Moon and became a musician despite being brought up in a house with only one album in it, but it was satirist and scientist Tom Lehrer, so that's a good start. You might hear more of that later. It is the great KT Tunstall, and this is our panel! Now, I thought we'd start, because we have two of the most eminent professors in the UK here, Professor Faye Dowker, Professor Jeff Forshaw, I thought we'd start by getting a feel for what quantum cosmology is and the ideas behind it. So, Marcus Bridstock, quickly, can you explain quantum cosmology in a minute?
In a minute, yes, I certainly can. Is that with deviation, repetition and hesitation? And can the benefit of the doubt go to anybody but me? Yes, I can explain it perfectly simply. If you go to the top of the Glastonbury Festival, by top I mean the highest point here, you reach the green fields and then you can look down on the entire Glastonbury Festival. And that, in a way, is probably the best metaphor in this short amount of time that I can think of to explain the thing that you asked me about. And another thing that is worth remembering is that on the way back from there, you can pass through what's known as the healing fields, or what I like to call the field of lies. They're very sweet lies. They're lovely. They don't mean any ill, but it is simply a field of lies. Ah, I see you're wearing spectacles. Rub these on them. What? You can't fix my eyesight like that. Lovely people, though.
Yeah. Katie, you were actually, your father was a physicist. You were brought up in a house
I'm here entirely vicariously through my father.
So what was it in terms of your experience with your father trying to explain some of these kind of incredible ideas?
Well, my dad loved his job, so he was just in the lab all the time. But he kind of played games with me and my brothers when we were little, and his favourite one was that liquid nitrogen came in a big canister on a kind of dolly trolley, and he'd take the liquid nitrogen off, put me and my brother on the trolley, slush the liquid nitrogen down the corridor, then put me and my brother on the trolley and go, "Don't touch!" and push us down the corridor. And it was amazing! And social services never found out about it.
So, Faye, we've got these two words, quantum cosmology. So if you could start by describing what cosmology is as a subject.
Cosmology is the study of the whole universe, all at once. So that does indeed include all of Glastonbury, everyone in this tent, absolutely everything. That's cosmology. But that's incredibly difficult. We couldn't possibly, in practice, explain everything all at once. So what we do in cosmology is we ask questions about the largest scales in the universe that we can see. So when we look out, we see that our sun is just one of 100 billion stars in our galaxy, and our galaxy is only one of 100 billion galaxies in the observable universe. The most important and interesting thing that we see when we look out and we see all these galaxies is that they are moving away from us. The universe itself is expanding, and it's expanding at a tremendous rate. And we know that, therefore, in the past, the universe must have been a lot smaller than it is now.
Sorry, I have a question. Yeah. Is the universe likely to keep on expanding and expanding, or is it like UKIP and we hope that that's sort of a blip?
We don't know the answer.
It sort of gets bigger for a bit, and then people go, "Oh, that's just silly."
We don't know the answer to that question completely, but on the evidence that we have right now, the expansion of the universe, its rate is actually increasing. So the rate of expansion is accelerating, and if that continues, then it will expand forever.
We're living in a Farage universe, is what you mean.
It's Farage. If you're that anti-European, it's Farage, not Farage. Farage.
Farage.
Farage as in garage.
Jeff, so why do we need quantum ideas in terms of what? Why do you need those ideas in explaining? Why is classical ideas of physics not enough to explain the basic ideas of this universe, of our universe?
Well, to understand how atoms work, then it's absolutely mandatory to understand how the tiny particles which make up all of the things in the universe, as far as we can tell, everything in the universe is made up of tiny particles, things like electrons, then to understand how those particles behave, we have to introduce these laws of quantum physics. And these laws are characterized by the fact that they are ridiculous. They're a complete affront to common sense. So you would be thinking about how an electron is behaving in the vicinity of a proton. That's a hydrogen atom. And the correct way to describe the electron in the vicinity of the proton is to suppose that that electron is in several different places at the same time. And again, just to embrace ideas like particles, a single particle can be in two places at once, is about as mind-blowing as it gets. And the cosmology project is really audacious. As Faye was saying, this is an attempt to describe the entirety of the universe, starting out at the very beginning. And it's so audacious that we're pretty certain that we can understand the evolution of the universe from a point when all of those billions and billions of stars were compressed into a volume about the size of a beach ball. So all of that at the size of a beach ball. From there on to the present day, we're reasonably confident that we actually understand the physics. Quantum effects come before then, earlier on.
That time is... what time frame are we talking about? From the Big Bang to the universe being the size of a beach ball?
It's something like 10 to the minus 25 seconds.
Katie, if you were to summarise that, we have, billions, 350 billion or so galaxies in the observable universe, large galaxies, compressed into the size of a beach ball. And Jeff's claim, the claim of modern physics, is we understand things pretty well from that point. The rest of this programme is talking about the universe before it got as big as a beach ball. What do you think?
Well, what fascinates me, the very little that I know about quantum mechanics and quantum physics, is that it basically seems to be that very little things don't necessarily like being looked at, and they sometimes behave a bit naughtily.
I love the fact you made them cheeky but shy particles.
Yeah.
There used to be an idea called panpsychism, which was that even the smallest particles actually had consciousness, right? Which I know is one of your favourites.
Stop!
Then,
no, but then love it.
I liked that idea till I then imagined the Large Hadron Collider and it became really melancholy, just where are we going? Round and round and round. Then it's the end. All this used to be fields.
I bet there's a really keen particle at CERN, though, going, isn't it fast, though?
Yeah.
We go fast. The Jeremy Clarkson of particles going,
there's
I went
like,
round the collider.
Yeah, one of those particles is going, let's break it again.
This is the rational tent. I'm not having this kind of conversation in the rational tent. It's just very, so in particle physics, which both myself and Jeff do, there seems to be no real conceptual problem in thinking about an electron doing multiple things at once around a proton, or at least it doesn't make us particularly uncomfortable. But when we move on to the universe and building a quantum picture, are we really saying that we can legitimately think of multiple universes with multiple things happening? Is that a signal that we don't understand physics correctly when we talk about quantum cosmology?
There's controversy on exactly that question. Quantum mechanics was invented, it was discovered to describe small things. And trying to apply it to the whole universe, we have to do something that quantum mechanics isn't set up to do. So the rules of quantum mechanics tell you how to make predictions about observations and measurements that you make on the quantum system. But when you're talking about the whole universe, there's nothing outside the universe to measure or observe us in the universe. We're all part of the universe, and we are supposed to be part of the quantum system when we do quantum cosmology. And the rules of quantum mechanics are just not set up for that situation.
Do serious quantum physicists, and I imagine most of you are fairly serious, spend time thinking a lot about the multiverse thing? Because it strikes me that it's a sort of, it's a campfire Greenfields bit of nitrous discussion. Yeah, you know, there could be a you and me over there. But considering it, does it have any practical effect on our understanding of this reality? Have you seen Sliding Doors? Did you cry?
So, the answer to that is yes. There are lots of serious physicists who take seriously the idea that there are multiple universes. It's very hard to test it, so they get criticised a lot for doing stuff which is not really physics. They need to think of a good way of testing that idea, a way of doing an experiment that would indicate that they're not just crazy. And so far, there have not been any experiments like that.
So Jeff's describing this interpretation of quantum theory as applied to a universe in which there really are multiple, actually infinite number of instances of all of us, all interfering together, an infinite number of universes. And Jeff has said that people take that seriously. What's your view on that kind of interpretation?
So I don't take that point of view. There are people who take that seriously. We're all struggling to understand what it means for the whole universe to be a quantum system. And this is one direction that people have taken that hypothesis in. I don't think that. I think there's just one instance of the universe. There aren't multiple copies of us. There's just us. But we still have to understand how to describe ourselves quantum mechanically. That's work in progress, as far as I'm concerned. The answer isn't, we don't know. We're doing research to figure out what it means for us to be quantum systems. And in doing quantum cosmology, that's one of the challenges, to understand what it means for the universe to be a quantum system.
Katie, Richard Feynman, the great physicist, he once said, anyone who says they understand quantum physics doesn't understand quantum physics, which is obviously a tremendous relief for Marcus and me.
Yeah,
and what do you feel, for you as someone, again, who's not a scientist but brought up in a scientist family, what are the hardest problems? What is the point where you go, now this bit is too counter-instinctive.
I mean, my poor dad used to come home from work and he'd go, look at my graph! And we'd go, shut up, Dad. Sit down, have your dinner. And no disrespect to any scientists who are here, but is there some things that human beings cannot yet understand? And obviously people who are specialists in this field are able to grasp it using language that is used in a way that we don't use it, granular, lumpy. But there's parts of it that I think that you can grasp onto, something like entanglement, where you've got two particles, they're separated by a vast distance, you do something to one of them, and this exact same thing happens to another one. That is surely proof of some sort of subatomic connectivity, you know, molecular connectivity that does apply to us. It's what we're made of, and it surely informs us that there's connection between things in this universe that we don't understand, and that when you do separate things from each other, it doesn't work, that the universe isn't necessarily working as a machine, it's an organism.
Casey raises a point there about perhaps the limits of human understanding. I mean, we're assuming that we should be able to comprehend and understand the universe as it was, as you said, when it's millions and millions of times smaller than a beach ball, in fact. And the observable universe is the tiny, microscopic, subatomic thing. Is there any reason to have confidence that we can actually begin to understand and answer these questions? Or could it be that we just reach a limit?
Well, what should be said first of all is that, I mean, it sounds very grand, as though there's some attempt to explain lots of things. But actually, everything that Faye and I have been talking about is characterised in large part by its simplicity and the fact that, for example, that nascent beach ball universe was actually less complicated than understanding what happens when you kick a bucket of water. The physics of the universe when it was very young was remarkably, as far as we understand it, remarkably simple. Likewise, the stuff that's going on at CERN involves taking one or two particles and just banging them into each other. The rules are straightforward, and we can apply the rules so we can understand how these little particles are behaving. Put that way, it doesn't sound very ambitious. So one thing that fundamental science is not capable of doing is explaining complicated phenomena, complicated things, how complicated things behave. That's another branch of science which is growing in interest, the study of complicated systems. So this fundamental physics, it's all about getting our basic ideas right about what the fundamental laws are that are in play in the universe. It's a far cry from understanding those fundamental laws. It's a bit like knowing the rules of chess. You can know the rules of chess, but that doesn't mean that you can play chess like Garry Kasparov.
We talked before as well about quantum ideas being possibly kind of a gateway to balderdash. Like, so you were saying, Mark, as you were up in the healing fields, and is there a possibility, you know, a problem where you have people go, well, ESP can be explained because the mind, a thing, quantum behaviour?
Well, you can't you? With a small amount of information but some big-sounding words, you can convince a lot of people of some things that certainly aren't true. I've built a fairly successful stand-up career on precisely that.
Katie, we were talking before about you've been watching some documentaries about quantum physics and quantum ideas, and when you, having been brought up in a scientific household, how do you try and sieve the kind of things you think, well, I think that may well be a scientific idea, and I think that might be possibly the work of a charlatan bamboozler with a new book to sell?
You usually look at what the person's wearing. And I always, basically, if there's excessive shaping of the beard, you usually don't trust them.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't say Jeff's is excessively
shaped.
Fairly
wild there, Marcus. It's, you know.
Yeah, mine's pretty loose. And grey on one side and not on the other, so...
You're not dying it.
That's coming. But I think the left side of my face may be travelling more quickly through time.
This is possible.
Than the right side of my face, and is therefore ageing faster.
That's an excellent theory, by the way, and
thank
it's going to do.
I
imagine your tent
then
will be in the healing field. So why is this side of my face so young? And you'll have your beach ball stall.
So we're just about to run out of time, actually. To begin to sum up then, Faye, where do you see this subject, this attempt to bring quantum theory and relativity together, quantum cosmology, where do you see it going in the next few years? What, are you optimistic?
I'm very optimistic. I think that, to answer an earlier question, the history of science has shown that every time we've been bold and have tried to understand something, then we've been successful. I mean, it's amazing what we have achieved in some tiny fraction of the history of the entire universe. So the human race has only existed for a mere fraction of the age of the universe. And we understand so much about the universe and our place in it. It's really thrilling and totally inspiring what we have managed to do so far. And that, I take great confidence and heart from that, and I think that there's nothing we can't understand if we try to. And I believe that these ideas will be fruitful. But they've got to be tested, has got to make predictions for things that we'll see when we look out and measure light from distant objects in the universe. It's got to have consequences for observation so we can test these ideas.
Marcus, do you feel that after this 27 minutes you now have a great grasp of quantum cosmology?
Define a great grasp, Robin. Can you narrow that down to a quantum amount?
Do you feel that around a campfire tonight at 4 a.m. you will be able to make people believe that you understand the work both of Einstein and beyond?
I tell you what, Robin, I don't think I will, but I think another me will.
And Katie, final question for you, which is, if we look at the many worlds interpretation, what is the perfect world for you in all of those different ones they split up?
Oh my, I would say 1973, watching Led Zeppelin. Were they?
Sweet.
Big gigging men?
So we're going to end on a song, because we should explain, right at the beginning we mentioned that Katie Tunstall only had at home, there was one album, and it was an album by Tom Lehrer, who is an incredible, is still alive today, though he hasn't recorded for many years, a great satirical writer and a great writer on science as well. And we decided that we would attempt possibly the worst sing-along of all time, one of the most complex pieces. Basically, it's a song called The Elements, and we're going to see what happens in this world when 3,000 tired and confused people attempt in approximately 2.5 minutes to sing a song which includes all the elements. I'm very pleased to say that we have, to help us do this, someone who is currently appearing at the festival. He's appearing with Four Puffs and a Piano. Please welcome to the stage, Roland Anderson! Come on, Brian, you lead the way. You have a grand musical tradition.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and helium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, and magnesium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. And strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, and lithium, beryllium, and barium. There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury and lithium and magnesium and dysprosium and scandium and cerium and tium and lead and zirconium and platinum and plutonium and beryllium and rhodium and potassium and molybdenum and tantalum and technetium and titanium and tellurium and cadmium and calcium and chromium and terbium. The news has come to Harvard, and then maybe any others that can happen to be
I suppose you know that that song is sung by Tom Lehrer, who rattled through it like a high-speed train, with no mistakes. But after all, he was a Harvard mathematician as well as a comic genius. And next week, as you heard, the Monkey Cage goes on space travel, that one-way trip to Mars. Science Extra on RN, I'm Robin Williams, here for the summer. And this year we said goodbye to Mike Morwood, about whom Lee Dayton talks next time. Mike discovered The Hobbit 10 years ago, and Chris Stringer from the Natural History Museum in London also knew him as a colleague. My first question to you, Chris Stringer, because you knew him, is about Mike Morwood, who died a few weeks ago, and the guy behind what's known as the Hobbit in Flores. Did you know him well?
I didn't know Mike well, but I'd met him and we'd corresponded, and obviously I was involved in the Hobbit story, because when it was published in Nature in 2004, the press conference launching the whole thing was actually in London, and I attended that press conference as an outside commentator, if you like, on the whole issue. So yes, I've been involved in that story all the way along, although I haven't actually studied any of the original fossils from there. But it is clearly an extremely important discovery, and Mike deserves tremendous credit for having the vision to think that there could be something really different going on there. Because, of course, when he began working on Flores, he and the rest of the team were expecting to find evidence of modern humans on the way to Australia. That was, I think, the aim of the project, digging there. But there was also evidence that there were stone tools that were very much older, possibly even a million years old, on Flores. And even that was remarkable, and he was able to confirm that that was so, because it showed that early humans had got much further in their original dispersals than we'd believe. They had crossed the Wallace line, which was thought to be only penetrated by modern humans.
Yes, and of course we're celebrating the anniversary of Wallace this year. And the one thing about what Mike did in that gigantic cave with his colleagues from Indonesia and from Australia and so on is dig really deep. Now that surprised me, because there's a suggestion that if you dig further down than a couple of metres, you're risking problems of collapse. And so usually archaeologists don't do that, but he did.
Well, that's right. Yes. He was obviously brave enough to do that. And of course, in the end, it becomes quite an engineering project, because you have to shore up the deposits to prevent them collapsing in on you. But yes, he had the vision to think that if you went deep enough in these caves, you would get beyond the last few thousand years and start to find material that could potentially be important, you know, in terms of the wider human story. And that's indeed what he did. And The Hobbit, as it's known so commonly, is still a very puzzling and challenging find, and it's a great sadness that Mike isn't around now to move this story on to its next chapter.
Dr. Chris Stringer from the Natural History Museum in London, and his book on us and our ancestors is called The Origins of Us. More from Lee Dayton next week on Mike Morwood and The Hobbit. And so to our PhD this week, though being in Oxford, we'll have to call it the DPhil. You know, Oxford, always tricky. But Will Hutchison, being a geologist, is definitely down to earth. He's based at University College, where Shelley and Bob Hawke did their bit. And Will's piece of earth is in Ethiopia.
For geologists, Ethiopia is one of the most spectacular places on the planet. Ethiopia's continental crust is slowly and gradually being torn apart by hot upwelling from deep within the earth. As the crust is gradually pulled apart, at a rate comparable to the speed that your fingernails grow, a new ocean is being born. This process of ocean formation is normally hidden from view deep beneath the seas, but in Ethiopia we can see and even walk right across the region where the earth is splitting apart. The pulling apart or rifting thins the Ethiopian continental crust. This means that we get higher temperatures much nearer the surface, leading to melting and magma generation, with the ultimate consequence of surface volcanism. And this is our principal area of research. The main Ethiopian rift, a valley 300 kilometres long and 80 kilometres wide, is our study area. The floor of the rift is essentially pan-flat, with massive lakes filling in any depressions. The climate is very hot, yet these lakes provide essential irrigation, and as a result, the rift valley can be lush with vegetation in places. A huge population has developed around these lakes. Flying down the rift, we would see all kinds of human habitats, sprawling cities and towns, as well as isolated communities living in mud huts. People live all over the rift valley. A large proportion of these people are subsistence farmers, but perhaps surprisingly, there are large industries employing vast local workforces, such as flower farms and even vineyards. Perched between the lakes and towns are the volcanoes. Some form large mountains of ash, pumice, and black glassy lava rising up high above the rift floor. Others create deep circular depressions several kilometres wide. These are immense craters in the rift floor where the ground has been excavated by explosive eruptions in the past. There is an intriguing paradox with these volcanoes. All show clear signs of large eruptions in the past. we see cubic kilometres of pumice and ash deposits, as well as the large scars left on the landscape by these explosions. But no significant eruptions have been noted in historical records. So the big question of our research is this: are these volcanoes simply remnants of more ancient and active past, or are they dormant, poised for future eruption? To answer these questions, we monitored the activity of the volcanoes, effectively checking their pulse. For this, we use radar instruments mounted on Earth-orbiting satellites, which can measure ground movement or deformation of the Earth's surface. This technique has two key advantages. First, we can monitor these volcanoes remotely from our desks in the UK. Second, it enables us to survey large areas of the rift. What have we found? Our colleague Dr. Juliet Biggs at the University of Bristol carried out a systematic survey using this satellite technique and identified that a host of these volcanoes along the Ethiopian Rift are actively deforming. This means that movement of material deep beneath the surface of the volcano is causing a measurable ground displacement at the surface. The most notable of these is Ulutu volcano. Ulutu showed two large uplift episodes in 2004 of 15 centimetres and 2008 of 10 centimetres, which took place over a couple of months. 15 centimetres may not sound like much, but as the signal is seen across the entire volcano, it in fact requires a large volume change beneath the surface. One of the best ways to imagine this is a giant balloon inflating beneath the volcano. Juliet's work confirms that these are indeed active volcanoes, and we're now trying to understand what is causing this volcanic unrest and whether we can make any predictions as to future activity. Our current work is focused on a detailed investigation of Ulutu volcano, which, we hope, will form one of the first detailed case studies of a main Ethiopian rift volcano. Since January last year, we've been busy deploying a dense network of monitoring equipment, including seismometers and GPS stations, and building up data on the past eruptions of the volcano. We are employing various different methods to build up the best picture we can of what's going on deep beneath the surface. My work, specifically, has been involved in looking at the eruptive history of the volcano. I've conducted several field studies, carefully logging and mapping the exposed rocks at the surface and collecting samples for chemical analysis and classification. One of the main difficulties we've had at Ulutu is that it covers a massive area, almost 15 kilometres in diameter. It's simply not possible to access and map the whole volcano. One of the ways we've managed to get around this issue is by using airborne survey data. In November last year, we had a research plane which flew out from the UK to capture images of Ulutu. The aircraft was equipped with very high-resolution digital cameras and instruments capable of measuring the topography of the volcano in exceptional detail. This airborne data is absolutely crucial to allow us to survey the inaccessible regions of the volcano, and integrating the airborne mapping techniques with our fieldwork really brings the eruptive history of the volcano into focus. What our work reveals is that Ulutu volcano has been through several eruptive cycles in the past. During these cycles, large explosive eruptions deposit thick sequences of pumice and pyroclastic debris. These are then quickly followed by eruptions of viscous, oozing lava formed of dark, glassy obsidian. Crucially, several thousand people live on Ulutu volcano, with many more in the surrounding towns and villages. Ulutu is just one of the 60 active volcanoes in Ethiopia, and not one has any dedicated monitoring network. With so few previous studies on these volcanoes, our hope is that this project will serve as a fundamental case study of the hazards which these volcanoes may pose to local populations. Only by establishing a detailed history of past eruptions and deploying a monitoring network can we achieve this.
That's very interesting. Now, how often do you actually go there? I know you said that you monitor sometimes from satellites, sometimes from aircraft or whatever, but you do field work. Do you actually go to Ethiopia reasonably often from Oxford?
Yeah, so I've been to Ethiopia 3 times now for about 6 weeks in total. My work really in the field is just, it's completely varied. Sometimes I'm looking at the deposits, mapping them, and just walking around, seeing what I can see. Other times I've been responsible for calibrating GPS networks and deploying monitoring sites on the ground.
Are they aware of the fact that they might be in some sort of danger from an eruption?
No, there's very little knowledge that what they even live on is an active volcano. So what's kind of quite worrying with Ethiopia is that, you know, unlike countries such as Indonesia and Chile, they've never really had a volcanic eruption to speak of. So there's very little kind of knowledge locally of what to do when a volcanic eruption happens, or nothing's been passed down. So it's a kind of bit of an unknown for them. Mm.
But isn't it interesting the way you're managing to combine field work on the ground and looking at stuff in fine detail, as well as from the sky and as well as making measurements from the sky?
Yeah, I mean, Alutia, as I said, is a massive volcano, and it's an impossible task to spend 6 weeks walking over it and see every bit of it. So, yeah, to that end, airborne data and satellite data is absolutely invaluable for us in trying to make a sensible story of the eruptive history of the volcano.
Well, you've done your first degree at Oxford in the college where Bob Hawke broke a few records, including Bury ones, and you're doing a doctorate here now. Still enjoying it?
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. Yeah, I really relish research, and I think, yeah, every day I'm quite happy and quite lucky that I get to go and study volcanoes in Ethiopia. It's something that's, I wouldn't say it's been a dream, but it's definitely very, very fun.
Will Hutchison, and you're with Science Extra on RN. In various parts of Africa, poachers are killing animals on a grotesque scale. And as you'll see in the latest edition of Scientific American, parts of these animals sold to the wealthy are financing terrorist exploits. This infuriates Dr. Rhys Halter, as you'll hear. He's a biologist with strong associations with Australia, living in Los Angeles.
There's a crisis of epic proportion occurring on our planet 24/7, 365. The war against nature has become a prolonged looting spree, plundering terrestrial and oceanic wildlife on a global tear never witnessed before. The fact that the mafia, syndicate, cartel, triads are involved heavily in shark finning, slaughtering bluefin tuna, massacring rhinos, elephants, and tigers, as the demand for rhino horns, elephant ivory, fur, and animal parts skyrockets, means these incredible beasts and others have no chance whatsoever to continue to live on planet Earth. What kind of a world are we leaving for our children? The destruction of nature, including illegal harvesting of forests for an unquenchable palm oil market and trafficking of animal parts, is valued in excess of $300 billion U.S. dollars annually. It now rivals that of drugs, arms, and human trafficking combined. No wonder organized crime is running this lucrative, life-ending business. And even more infuriatingly, Japan, Iceland, and Norway continue to hunt whales despite a 1986 worldwide moratorium. Japan harpoons whales in the Great Southern Ocean within an international sanctuary where populations of great whales are no more than 3% of what they were a mere 200 years ago. Japan claims to hunt whales under the auspice of scientific research, which is simply not true. Poaching has reached a frenzied level elsewhere. The pictures of these magnificent rhinos dehorned while still alive in Kruger National Park, South Africa, are enough to make a grown man cry. Organized gangs, often from neighboring Mozambique, of 4 to 6 men, are well-armed and carrying devices facilitating constant communications. They infiltrate communities, buy information on rhino whereabouts, and then devise escape routes, while at the same time familiarizing themselves with security structures and movements of park rangers. It's cold, calculated, ruthless murder. These depraved poachers shoot the rhinos in their knees, slice their Achilles tendons and spines, thereby immobilizing them while sawing and hacking off horns weighing 7 kilograms with a street value of well over $500,000 U.S. These colossal creatures are then left to bleed to death slowly. These heartless thugs organize pickups, which hide horns and weapons for collection later on. They quickly change into fresh clothes and shoes, as boot prints can link them to the crime scene when inspected at follow-up roadblocks. Large sums of cash are immediately paid to poachers upon delivery of rhino horns. Organized crime has established and structured nefarious business models, which operate locally, and like the wide base of a pyramid, it moves upward from regional to national couriers, buyers, and exporters to their international counterparts, supplying international buyers who sell to international nouveau riche consumers at the top. The price of the rhino horn varies from $65,000 to $100,000 U.S., a kilogram. At the top end of this range, rhino horn per kilogram is about 2.5 times more valuable than 24-karat gold. This voracious demand for rhino horn is coming from Vietnam, China, and Thailand. In 2010, a rumor began circulating that a Vietnamese minister's relative was cured of cancer by rhino horn powder. In addition, Chinese medicine routinely uses rhino horn to purportedly cure a range of ailments, from rheumatism to ridding the soul of the devil. The number of Oriental nouveau riche is burgeoning. In Vietnam alone, since 2008, the number of millionaires has increased by 150%. At the same time, Vietnamese cancer rates are spiking by 30% annually, in large part due to horrendous environmental degradation. Sadly, rhino horn is now seen in the Orient as a status symbol, and it has become a magnet for the nouveau riche. Over the past 113 years, the human population has soared from 1.6 to 7.1 billion. Rhino numbers, on the other hand, have plummeted from 500,000 to 29,000, a 95% decrease. And worse, since 2007, poaching rhinos has increased by 5,000%. At this crazed rate, rhinos will be extinct by 2022. In September of 2013, in Wangay National Park, Zimbabwe, poachers, the scourge of our planet, annihilated 90 more African elephants by poisoning their waterhole with cyanide. Earlier in September of 2013, in the park, they poisoned 40 elephants in an attempt to feed the insatiable Asian demand for ivory, which now fetches $2,200 a kilogram. To give you some idea of how quickly earthlings are exterminating elephants, in 1980, there were about 1.2 million African beasts. Last year, the estimate was at most 400,000 remaining. Since 2002, the African forested elephant population has plummeted by 76%. In Tanzania alone, the population estimate in 2008 was approximately 165,000. Today, there are fewer than 23,000 elephants left. The Obama administration, led by Hillary Clinton, has pledged to step up the fight to save the elephants. In September of 2013, 6 tons of ivory was seized in the U.S. And earlier in 2013, the Philippines announced that it had crushed 15 tons of elephant ivory. There are simply not enough animals remaining on the planet at the current rate of this prolonged pillaging of 21 tons of elephant ivory confiscated within 1 year. An even more maddening question is, how many more tons are being gobbled up each year on the black market? Unknown, vast quantities. My colleagues have clearly shown that both filter-feeding whales like humpbacks and large and small-toothed whales like the dolphins play an essential role in keeping the web of sea life intact and vibrant. The filter feeders fertilize the ocean with their nitrogen-rich, flocculent fecal plumes, stimulating phytoplankton, enriching the marine ecosystem, and creating abundant fisheries. Toothed whales cull the old and weak fish and seal populations, preventing diseases from reaching epidemics, thus ensuring a high level of fitness throughout the seas. In the spring of 2012, over 900 long-beaked common dolphins and black porpoises washed up in a mass mortality event on Peruvian shores. Government officials stating that the dolphins died of natural causes like morbillivirus did not convince my colleagues and me. The conservation group Orca Peru undertook 30 necropsies from 3 separate expeditions. What they discovered was indeed disturbing and contrary to the Peruvian production minister Gladys Trebino's claim that the death of the dolphins were not caused by any human activity. Off the coast of Peru, oil production Corvina and Albacore Field conducted a series of powerful seismic tests during the first half of 2012. Orca Peru scientists found that the dolphins and porpoises they examined exhibited bleeding in their middle ears as well as fractured skulls. In addition, lungs, livers, stomachs, bladders, skin, spleens, and blubber all displayed gas bubbles, or what scuba divers know and fear as decompression sickness, or the bends. There was no evidence whatsoever of morbillivirus in any of the 30 necropsies. What happened to those magnificent Peruvian beasts appears to have reoccurred in September of 2013, but this time along the West African coast of Ghana. The war against nature, specifically the whales and dolphins, is set to rage beginning early 2014 as the U.S. Navy will start training exercises including deep-sea explosions and sonar testing along the East Coast, Gulf of Mexico, Southern California, and Hawaii, running them until 2019. The U.S. Navy announced that computer models predicted hundreds of whales and dolphins would die, whilst thousands will suffer serious injuries, and millions will temporarily lose hearing and suffer major behavioral changes, including getting lost. Humans cannot live without nature. Nature, on the other hand, can totally exist without us. It's time to end the war against nature now and protect the remaining great whales, dolphins, rhinos, elephants, big cats, polar bears, grizzly bears, gorillas, bluefin tunas, sharks, sea turtles, and my favorite, the albatross, from despicable poachers.
An angry Dr. Rhys Halter in Los Angeles. A stern thought for the end of 2013. Another Science Extra next week. Next year, in fact. Production today by David Fisher. And after the news, Jonathan Green and Background Briefing.